And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, it is the 21st day of October. This year's whipping by. It's 294th day of the year. Only 71 days remain till the year's over with. Well, there's a lot going on. We've got protest. Folks that wouldn't have been given 5 minutes of fame are suddenly in the headlines, speaking for their people. Now, this, supposedly Trump caused a great divisiveness among the population, but what he did was nothing compared to what's happening now. We got Alyssa Milano out there protesting because she doesn't agree with something somebody else said. I don't know who put her in charge of what people say, but apparently she thinks she is. And having been a star in her mind, we should all listen to her. Well, I just wish they would all fold up their little tents and go back home and watch reruns of their shows on TV and leave the rest of us alone. Netflix has had major walkouts. Turns out the person that organized didn't let it wasn't a Netflix employee. But this individual speaks for everyone, don't you know? Well, there's been a lot of folks like Alyssa Milano throughout history. And it's resulted in a lot of death and destruction. One of the first was the People's Crusade. Was it the beginning phase of the First Crusade? They were going to retake the Holy Land from Islamic occupation. It was the first, the largest, and best documented of the popular crusades. It only lasted 6 months. It was also known as the Peasants' Crusade and the Paupers' Crusade. Wasn't part of the official church-organized expeditions that came later. It was led primarily by somebody named Peter the Hermit. Put together an untrained peasant army that was destroyed by the forces of the Seljuk Turks under Kılıç Arslan at the Battle of Shivalat in northwestern Anatolia. As usual, this Peter the Hermit, he spoke for God. You had to listen to him. That took place in 1096. 1097, Crusaders led by Godfrey Bouillon, a Bohemian of Taranto, and Raymond IV, Count of Toulouse, began the siege of Antioch. Then in 1209, Otto IV is crowned Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Innocent III, and he was not innocent, let me assure you. 1392, Japanese Emperor Go Kameyama abdicates in favor of rival claimant Go Komatsu. 1512, Martin Luther joins the theological faculty at the University of Wittenberg. He was another person that opposed the existing order. 1520, Ferdinand Magellan discovers a strait now known as the Strait of Magellan. Also in 1520, Alvarez Fagundes discovers the islands of St. Pierre and Miquelon, throwing them their original name of the islands of the 11,000 virgins. I doubt they found that many virgins there. 1600, Tokugawa Ieyasu defeats the leaders of the rival Japanese clans in the Battle of Sekigahara and becomes Shogun of Japan. 1774, the flag of Teuton, Massachusetts is the first to include the word liberty. 1797, in Boston Harbor, the 44-gun U.S. Navy frigate USS Constitution is launched. For those that are not history fanatics. It was also known as Old Ironsides. It's a wooden-hulled, three-masted heavy frigate of the U.S. Navy. It's the world's oldest ship of any type still afloat. Launched, as I said, in 1797, one of six original frigates authorized for construction by the Naval Act of 1794, and the third one to be constructed. The name Constitution was among 10 names submitted to President Washington by Secretary of War Timothy Pickering in March of 1795. Joshua Humphreys designed the frigates to be the young Navy's capital ships, and the Constitution and her sister ships are larger, more heavily armed, and built than standard frigates of the period. Constitution is most noted for her actions during the War of 1812 against the UK, when she captured numerous merchant ships and defeated five British warships. The battle with Guerrero, the HMS Guerrero, earned her the nickname Old Ironside, and public adoration kept her from being scrapped. She continued to serve as flagship in the Mediterranean and the African squadrons and circled the world in the 1840s. During the Civil War, she served as a training ship for the Naval Academy. It was retired from active service in 1881 and served as a receiving ship until it was designated a museum ship in 1907. Well, 1805, Napoleonic Wars. British fleet, led by Lord Nelson, defeats a combined French and Spanish fleet under Admiral Villanueva in the Battle of Trafalgar. 1824, Portland cement is patented. 1854, Florence Nightingale and a staff of 38 nurses are sent to the Crimean War. 1861, American Civil War. Union forces under Colonel Edward Baker are defeated by Confederate troops in the second major battle of the Civil War. 1867, the Medicine Lodge Treaty signed by Southern Great Plains Indian leaders. The treaty required Native American Plains tribes to relocate to a reservation in western Oklahoma. 1879, Thomas Edison applied for a patent for his design for an incandescent light bulb. 1888, the Swiss Social Democratic Party is founded. 1892, the opening ceremonies for the World's Columbian Exposition is held in Chicago. Because construction was behind schedule, the exposition didn't open until May 1st of 1893. 1895, the Republic of Formosa collapses as Japanese forces invade. 1907, the Kwarantag earthquake hits the borders of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, kills between 12,000 and 15,000 people. 1910, HMS Niobe arrives in Halifax Harbor and becomes the first ship of the Royal Canadian Navy. 1921, President Harding delivers the first speech by a sitting U.S. president against lynching in the Deep South. 1931, a secret society in the Imperial Japanese Army launches an abortive coup d'etat attempt. They were going to overthrow the emperor and put Japan back on the proper course. In 1940, the first edition of the Ernest Hemingway novel For Whom the Bell Tolls is published. 1943, World War II, the Provisional Government of Free India is formally established and Japanese-occupied Singapore. 1944, World War II, the first kamikaze attack damages HMAS Australia in the Battle of Leyte Gulf. Also in 44, the Nimmersdorf massacre against the German civilians takes place. Now, for those that are not familiar with that, it was perpetrated by Red Army soldiers in the late stages of World War II. It Maykovskoye Kaliningrad Oblast, one of the first pre-war ethnic German villages to fall to the advancing Red Army during the war. On October 21st, 1944, Soviet soldiers killed a lot of German civilians as well as French and Belgian POWs. It was the 2nd Battalion, 25th Guards Tank Brigade, belonging to the 2nd Guards Tank Corps of the 11th Guards Army, crossed the Angerop Bridge and established a bridgehead on the western bank of the Raminte River. German forces tried to retake the bridge, but a number of attacks were repelled by the Soviet tanks and the supporting infantry. During an air attack, a number of Soviet soldiers took shelter in an improvised bunker already occupied by 14 local men and women. According to testimony of a seriously injured woman, Gerda Megzolot, when a Soviet officer arrived and ordered everybody out, the Soviet shot and killed the German civilians at close range. During the night, the Soviet 25th Tank Brigade was ordered to retreat back across the river and take up defensive positions. The Wehrmacht came in and regained control of Nimmersdorf and discovered the massacre. A lot of hard feelings in that war on both sides. 1944, the city of Aachen falls to American forces after 3 weeks of fighting, making it the first German city to fall to the Allies. 1945, on this date, French women vote for the first time during the 1945 French legislative election. 1950, Korean War. Heavy fighting begins between the British and the Australian forces against the North Koreans during the Battle of Yeongju. 1956, the Mau Mau Uprising in Kenya is defeated. 1959, in New York City, the Solomon Guggenheim Museum opens to the public. I went there. 1959, President Eisenhower approves the transfer of all U.S. Army space-related activities to NASA, including most of the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. 1965, Comet Akiyo-Seki approaches perihelion, passing 450,000 kilometers from the sun. That was 279,000 miles. 1966, a colliery spoil-tip collapses on the village of Aberfan in Wales, kills 144 people. 116 of those 144 were schoolchildren. 1967, a National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam organizes a march of 50,000 people from the Lincoln Memorial to the Pentagon. And that was another action by people who never served, had no idea what was going on, but by God, they were going to be activists. 1969, the 69 Somali coup d'etat establishes a Marxist-Leninist administration. 1971, a gas explosion kills 22 people at a shopping center in Glasgow, Scotland. 1973, Fred Dreyer, the Los Angeles Rams, becomes the first major player in NFL history to score two safeties in the same game. You may remember him. He went on to become an actor. He starred in the series Hunter. I remember watching that. It wasn't bad. 1978, Australian civilian pilot Frederick Valentich vanishes over the Bass Strait south of Melbourne after reporting contact with an unidentified aircraft. Actually, what he reported was an unidentified flying object. It was thought that he may have been kidnapped by a UFO. 1979, Moshe Dayan resigns from the Israeli government because of strong disagreements with Prime Minister Menachem Begin over policy toward the Arabs. He was a very well-known military leader. 1981, Andreas Papandreou becomes Prime Minister of Greece, ending an almost 50-year-long system of power dominated by conservative forces. 1983, the meter is defined as the distance light travels in a vacuum, and 99,792,458th of a second. 1984, Niki Lauda claims his third and final Formula One Drivers' Championship title by half a point ahead of McLaren teammate Alain Prost at the Portuguese Grand Prix. 1986 in Lebanon, pro-Iran kidnappers claimed to have abducted American rider Edward Tracy. He got released in August of 91. 1987, the Jaffna hospital massacres carried out by Indian peacekeeping forces in Sri Lanka killed 70 Tamil patients, doctors, and nurses. Now, troops of the Indian peacekeeping force entered the premises. It was a teaching hospital in Jaffna, Sri Lanka, and killed between 60 and 70 patients and staff. The rebel Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, the government of Sri Lanka, and independent observers such as University Teachers for Human Rights and others, called it a massacre of civilians. Now, the Indian Army claimed their soldiers were fired on, and the Indian Army officer in charge of the military operations, Lieutenant General Dipinder Singh, claimed that these civilians were killed in a crossfire between soldiers and rebels. Soldiers responsible for the massacre were not prosecuted by the Indian government. The problem is the non-military observers, if you will, were all activists, and you don't know who to believe. 1994, North Korea and the United States signed an agreed framework that requires North Korea to stop its nuclear weapons program and agree to inspections. Of course, that didn't come to pass. Also in 1994, in Seoul, South Korea, 32 people were killed when a span of the Seongsu Bridge collapses. 2005, images of the dwarf planet Eris are taken and subsequently used in documenting its discovery. Now it's the most massive and second largest known dwarf planet in the solar system. It's a trans-Neptunian object. It has a high eccentricity orbit. As a member of the scattered disk discovered in January 2005 by a Palomar Observatory-based team led by Mike Brown, and it wasn't until a year later the discovery was verified. It was named after the Greco-Roman goddess of strife and discord. It's the ninth most massive known object orbiting the sun and the 16th most massive overall in the solar system. It's also the largest object that has been visited by a spacecraft. Its mass is 0.27% of the Earth and 127% of Pluto, although Pluto was slightly larger by volume. It orbits the sun, completes one rotation every 25.9 hours, making its day length similar to Earth's. Of course, there's disagreement about the rotation period. It's got one large known moon, Dysnomia. In February 2016, the distance from the sun was 96.3 astronomical units, roughly three times that of Pluto. With the exception of some long period comets, until 2018 was discovered in 2018 VG was discovered December 17, 2018. Eris and Dysnomia were the most distant known natural objects in the solar system. Well, there's a lot about the solar system we don't know. 2019, 30 people are killed in a bus crash in Western Democratic Republic of Congo. And in 2019 in Canada, the 2019 Canadian federal election ends, resulting in incumbent Prime Minister Justin Trudeau remaining in office, although he has a minority government. Yeah, that pretty much ends our little history segment. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. In the United Kingdom, we have Apple Day. In Honduras, we have Armed Forces Day. Christian feast days, Asterius of Ostia, Berthold of Parma, Blessed Charles of Austria in the Roman Catholic Church, Fintan of Tagmon, Hilarion, John of Bridlington, Laura of St. Catherine of Siena, Letitia, Malchus of Syria, Peter U.T. Chol, So Verinus of Bordeaux, Truda of Lindisfarne, Ursula, Viator of Lyon, Egyptian Naval Day in Egypt, Indian Police Commemoration Day in India, National Nurses Day in Thailand, Yadaya Day in Burundi, Overseas Chinese Day in Republic of China, Trafalgar Day in the British Empire in the 19th and early 20th century, and Birth of the Bab in the Bahia faith. All right, let's see what else we've got. In 310, St. Eusebius ends his reign as Catholic Pope. In 335, Roman Emperor Constantine the Great rules that Jews are not allowed to purchase and circumcise Christian slaves. Some of the rules we've had in history just absolutely baffle me. And in 686, Conan begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 1096, the Sultan Khalidji Arslan of Nicaea. As I said, he defeated the People's Crusade at the Battle of Kvitat. Of the 20,000 members of the People's Crusade, only about 3,000 survive. And 1555, Emperor Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor, makes Irad of Pallant, Earl of Coolimburg. 1555, the English Parliament refuses to recognize Philip of Spain as king. In 1639, sea battle at the Dunes. Lieutenant Admiral Martin Tromp defeats the Spanish Armada under de Oquendo. 1652, King Louis XIV, the Sun King, returns to Paris. 1805, in the Battle of Trafalgar that I talked about, British Admiral Nelson defeats the combined French and Spanish fleet. He's shot and killed during the battle by a marksman on board one of the French ships. 1861, the Battle of Ball's Bluff in Virginia, also known as Leesburg and Harrison's Island. 1864, Battle of Westport, Missouri, also known as Kansas City. And in 1869, the first shipment of fresh oysters comes overland from Baltimore. Well, we've been talking over the last few shows about threats and plots and assassination attempts against various presidents. And it was suggested that I might take a day and talk about some other things. So, since I like to be responsive to my listeners who send me emails, let's talk about the death of James Dean. You know, it's now almost 60 years since James Dean died. Although, like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis, he's still with us when songs and movies and posters and mugs and postcards and anything else you can think of. He was the first rebel without a cause. We got so many of those today. But he certainly wasn't the last. He died in 1955. And though he had really just gotten his career started, he was eulogized as a great actor. But he came to epitomize the 50s, and in particular, the jeans and t-shirt wearing teenagers of his generation. Born February 8th, 1931. Name was James Byron Dean. Raised in Maryland, Indiana. And went on to live in Santa Monica, where he lived a normal life with his mother, Mildred, and father, Winton. Unfortunately for the child, his mother developed cancer and died when Dean was just 9 years old. So he was raised by his aunt and uncle as his father could no longer care for the boy. He wasn't exactly an exceptional student, preferred sports to the basics such as math and literacy. But he did enjoy drama with his teacher, Ms. Nail. Seeing it was these early lessons that planted a seed of his acting talent and attracted his interest. He graduated in 1949 and moved back to California with his father, where the young man started college and majored in pre-law. Now, his family, of course, was thrilled, but it wasn't long before Dean grew bored with the subject and changed his studies to drama at the University of California at L.A. Much to the chagrin of his father, who couldn't see any point in studying such a frivolous activity. It was while at UCLA he had the opportunity to act in Macbeth that gave the young man enough confidence in his abilities to believe he no longer needed to study the craft full time. He wanted to put what he'd learned into action. With this in mind, he dropped out of college and endeavored to work as a full-time actor. But he found himself offered only bit parts and the occasional commercial. But in spite of that, he wasn't prepared to give up on the career he wanted. It wasn't long before he moved across the country to New York, where he studied his craft and gained work on TV. Now, as you might guess, he was something of a complex young man. He was a moody character, deep thinker who was complicated and emotional and totally dedicated to his craft. Worked hard and paid his dues in all manner of acting roles on TV and in the theater. In spite of that, he actually only had three major films to his credit. The first was East of Eden, which began shooting in April of 1954. Now, that film, of course, was a big success and got Dean an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor. Unfortunately, by the time that came to be, and the actor had already died, and in the end, the award went to Ernest Borgnine for his performance in Marty. Now, Dean's next movie was maybe his most famous and still frequently seen on TV nearly 60 years after it came out. That was Rebel Without a Cause, the movie that really seemed to give teenagers a name and introduce the world to their angst and problems, particularly problems related to their relationship with their parents. And young people around the world identified with Dean's character, whose name was Jim Stark in the film. They cut their hair like his, took to wearing white t-shirts and blue jeans just like their hero. And it gave Dean a huge degree of success, and it'd be fair to say without it that maybe there wouldn't have been the amount of publicity surrounding the actor that we still see today. And next came the movie Giant, which saw Dean playing Jet Rink, an outcast who strikes oil and becomes a baron. Very different character to those he played in Rebel and East of Eden. This film saw Dean cast alongside Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson. And he grew fond of Taylor and during the filming. And so much so it was rumored he once told her that he'd been molested as a child by a local minister. Well, since neither person's around in order to substantiate the story, it's impossible to say if it really happened or just a product of hearsay and gossip. Where the movie Giant was filmed, which is here in Texas, in a little town nearby, in the hotel where they stayed. And the building is haunted, and some say it's haunted by the ghost of James Dean. Regardless of whether he ever admitted such a thing, the two actors had become close friends, and Taylor presented Dean with a cat that he called Marcus, who lived with him until he died. When a reporter telephoned Elizabeth after Dean died, she was shocked and couldn't seem to find any words. She said, "I can't believe it. I'm just stunned." And then she hung up. Well, Giant wasn't entirely finished at the time James Dean died and still needed to be edited and polished. And with this in mind, Nick Adams, an actor from Rebel and Dean's friend, took on the task of dubbing some of Dean's lines during the process. Still, the fact the film had been edited or even seen before his death, did nothing to diminish his likability. In 1956, Dean got his second Academy Award nomination. He lost out to Yul Brynner for his portrayal of the King and the King of I. And while he may not have won the award, James Dean did manage to become something of a record breaker when he became the only actor ever to receive two posthumous and consecutive nominations for acting. Away from his career, he was a keen racing driver and had a deep love for motorbikes and cars. Now, friends worried about this hobby. He'd often take his interest off the racetrack, instead go pelting down the highways with seemingly no regard for his personal safety. Warner Brothers was concerned enough about this to ban Dean from all racing during the making of Giant, which he didn't appreciate at all. He did, ironically, manage to record a public service announcement during the making of the film, warning young people of the dangers of speeding on the highway, during which he shared his thoughts. He said, "I used to fly around quite a bit and took a lot of unnecessary chances on the highway. Then I started racing, and now when I drive on the highway, I'm extra cautious because nobody knows what they're doing." He then urged the youngsters to take care when driving because the life you save might be mine. Well, on September 21st, 1955, just after filming on Giant had ended, Dean invested in a new Porsche 550 Spyder, christened it the Little Bastard, though the inspiration behind that name remains unclear. Some say it was a direct dig at Jack Warner, who once apparently called Dean such a name, while others insisted it was a nickname given to him by a friend. Whatever the reason behind the moniker might be, there were several people who had an uneasy feeling about that vehicle, including British actor Alec Guinness, who met James Dean just 7 days before he died. Young actor showed Guinness his car and asked him what he thought about it, and he's supposed to have said, "If you get in that car, you'll be found dead in it by this time next week." Well, Dean no doubt thought that comment somewhat amusing, and instead of avoiding the car, as Guinness suggested, decided to enter it into the Salinas Road Race, which was to take place on the 1st and 2nd of October, 1955. Now, James Dean was known to have something of an obsession with death and was once even photographed sitting inside a coffin. He confessed to friends he didn't expect to live long, that he wanted to do everything quickly because he knew that time was running out for him. One friend said he was an extreme individualist, nonconformist, to believe in acting and living as he pleased. September 30th, 1955, he climbed into his Porsche together with friend and mechanic Rolf Wutherick, and this set off of Salinas, followed by friend Bill Hickman and photographer Sanford Roth, who had photographed Dean shortly before they left. Those candid shots of the actor with the customary cigarette hanging from his mouth were the last to be taken of him. The idea had been for all four men to travel in a station wagon with the Porsche strapped to the back, but moments before they left, Dean had a change of heart and decided it'd be better if he drove the sports car in order to break it in for the road race. And that decision ultimately cost him his life. As Dean tore down the highway with Wutherick sitting beside him, he was pulled over by California Highway Patrolman O.V. Hunter, who warned the actor he was driving 65 miles an hour instead of the legal 55. Hickman, who was driving behind, was also ticketed, and after the episode, the party continued on their way, stopping briefly at Blackwell Corners for refreshments before heading toward Paso Robles in order to meet up with friends for dinner that evening. Shortly before 6 p.m., at about 19 miles east of Paso Robles, Dean's car was involved in a head-on collision at the intersection of Highway 41 and 466. Well, the crash happened quickly and came on a Ford coupe being driven by a young man named Donald Turnipseed. Suddenly turned in front of Dean's car. The force of the collision was so violent and at such a velocity Dean's car flew up into the air. The Ford slid almost 40 feet down the highway. Well, both Turnipseed and Wutherick were injured in the crash. The mechanic suffered a fractured jaw and hip and numerous other injuries. On being taken to the hospital, he was described as being in a moderately serious condition. Turnipseed's car was a write-off. Its owner got away with fairly minor injuries. So much so, in fact, when officers arrived on the scene, they interviewed the young man and quite bizarrely told him to leave his destroyed vehicle at the roadside and hitchhike his way home to Tulare. He did as he was instructed, despite having just been involved in a head-on collision and all the shock that brings with it. Found his way home in the dark, thanks to the kindness of strangers. But while the two men were obviously shocked and physically hurt, they did manage to get out of the crash alive. Same can't be said for James Dean, though, who suffered a broken neck, other broken bones, and lacerations all over his body. His foot had been crushed between the pedals, and he had internal injuries as well, so that by the time Hickman and Roth arrived on the scene, 10 minutes later, he was all but dead. Two men were stunned to see the wreckage in front of them, and Hickman spent time getting his friend out of the wreckage in order to try and help him. Roth took some photos of the mangled car, some of which can be seen on websites that have sprung up over the years. And while the photos are not pleasant to look at, they do show the extent to which the vehicle was destroyed on impact, and it was frankly a mystery that anybody got out alive. An ambulance finally arrived on the scene and rushed James Dean to Paso Robles War Memorial Hospital. He was pronounced dead. Later reports would surface that Dean's last words were, "That guy's got to stop. He'll see us." He was referring to Turnip Seed's vehicle, but since the crash happened so quickly, they admitted he was sneezing at the time of impact, was therefore in no fit state to see or hear much at all. So nobody really knows if Dean actually said anything. 7 weeks after the crash that killed the world's most famous up-and-coming young actor, a coroner's inquest was held to determine what exactly had happened. During the proceedings, witnesses Tom Fredericks and his brother-in-law Tom Dooley shocked everybody by claiming it wasn't Dean driving the car at the moment of impact, but the mechanic. Well, this raised eyebrows around the room, but it was categorically denied by the mechanic himself, who was still in the hospital recovering from the impact of the crash. According to him, he was very definitely just the passenger of the vehicle. But nearly 60 years later, rumors abound that he was the driver. Now, he wasn't, but he never fully got over the crash, suffering depression and staying in the hospital for 18 months immediately after the accident. A tragic twist occurred in 1981 when Lutherick really was driving a car that was involved in the crash. He lost control and drove straight into a house, becoming mangled in the wreckage to such a degree that special equipment was needed to get him out. Like James Dean more than 25 years before, Lutherick tragically passed away at the scene. He escaped one major collision, but couldn't survive another. Well, Turnip Seed talked briefly to a reporter after the accident and never mentioned it again, deciding he needed to concentrate on the future rather than the past. He swore at the moment of impact he hadn't seen Dean's small Porsche and spent the rest of his life fending off reporters and authors and fans and passers-by determined to dish the dirt on the death of James Dean and Turnip Seed's part in it. So intrusive was the attention, in fact, that people would often trudge their way up his garden path in the hope of being granted an interview. Well, they were never lucky enough to get that interview. Instead, they were being able to talk to the man at the center of the scandal. They were instead met by furious family members and quickly sent on their way. Poor man lived under the shadow of the actor's death till his own eventual death in 1995. When the inquest into Dean's death was complete, his death was ruled an accident and the case was closed. Meanwhile, the actor's funerals, handled by his father, Wenton, who traveled to Paso Robles after the death in order to oversee his son's body's return to Fairmont, Indiana. The funeral itself was held at Fairmont Friends Church, October 8, 1955, attended by over 3,000 people. That's a staggering number and said to be more than the entire population of his hometown at that time. His pallbearers were said to be friends from his school, and he was buried in Fairmont's Park Cemetery later that day. Now, this should have been the end of the story, but actually it wasn't anywhere close. The headstone that was chosen for the plot went on to have a rather checkered story of its own. 1983, that marker was stolen 3 times from the cemetery. It was returned twice and then disappeared for good. Hadn't been seen since. If somebody stole it as a memento, they certainly kept quiet about it. Well, another headstone was placed on the spot shortly after the first was stolen, only to go missing itself in 1998. This time it did manage to find its way back when a sheriff found it after it had been dumped on a country road 60 miles away. It was returned to the cemetery and 2 metal rods secured it to the ground to prevent further theft. Now, this hadn't stopped memorabilia hunters who have come to the grave over the years to chip away pieces of stone for their creepy collection. those that have been questioned say they do it because they're fans. Know what Dean's family and friends think of this unsavory and hugely disrespectful ritual is something else entirely. More appropriate way of remembering the young actor was undertaken in 2005 on the 50th anniversary of James Dean's death. Despite the original accident intersection being restructured and moved over the years, though the original road can still be seen, the new layout was named the James Dean Memorial Junction in a small plaque situated at the spot where the accident took place. Now everybody who drives down that particular stretch of road is reminded of the man who lost his life there, and maybe they drive a little more slowly as well. As James Dean himself said, the life you save might be mine. There's been a number of stories about what happened to the car itself. Pieces of it apparently were sold to various collectors who put them on their own cars, and they're supposed to have had accidents. Maybe yes, maybe no. Another mystery from the Hollywood era had to do with the mysterious deaths of Lana Turner's boyfriend. Now, in terms of Hollywood actresses, you don't get much bigger than Lana Turner. She was known as the Blonde Bombshell. She was a star in every sense of the word. She exuded glamour and sophistication and sex appeal. But when her boyfriend, Johnny Stampinato, was killed in her Beverly Hills mansion, her career and reputation looked as though they'd be tarnished forever. Now, she was born in Wallace, Idaho, February 8, 1921. Her name was Julia Jean Turner, the woman who'd grew up to be known as Lana. She was raised for the most part in California, first in San Francisco and later in L.A. Childhood wasn't the happiest of sorts, and at an early age, she lost her father after he was mugged and murdered on his way home from a craps game. Now, that crime was never solved, and as a result of having no father, the family was impoverished and often split apart, while Lana's mother, Mildred, worked all the hours she could just to put food on the table. Now, during these times, Lana would move in with friends till her mother was able to get her back in the family home, but it was often a gruesome few months, particularly when some of the family she lived with treated her as if she was her personal servant and dog's body. Lana herself later wrote that the servant was too good a word for how she was treated in the homes where she stayed, and she described her life as like a cheap Cinderella, but with no hopes of a pumpkin or a fairy godmother. Also told that she was beaten so badly that she bled, leading her mother to despair when she eventually found out what was going on. When she entered her teens, Lana and her mother moved to L.A., where they hoped to live a better life. And things did look up while they were there. Lana enrolled in Hollywood High School, where her mother regained employment as a beautician, though the hours were awful, often 80 hours a week. This meant that Lana became something of a latchkey kid, letting herself into the house after school and fending for herself until her mother got home from work. Well, depending on who you believe, Lana Turner was discovered at the soda fountain at Swab's Drugstore or in the Top Hat Cafe. And it really doesn't matter where the location was. The most important thing was that the 16-year-old was spotted by William Wilkerson, the publisher of Hollywood Reporter and a successful talent scout. He asked her if she'd like to be an actress, to which she replied, "I'll have to ask my mother," and she did, and the mother said it was okay. So Wilkerson put her in touch with producer and director Mervyn LeRoy, who cast her for a small role in his next movie, They Won't Forget. This was in the year 1937. Although only on the screen for a matter of minutes, Turner made a big impression on fans, particularly because of the way her breasts bounced in her sweater as she walked down the street. After that, columnists began calling her the young woman the sweater girl. Although this was a tag Lana hated, and if truth be known, the part in They Won't Forget wasn't one of her personal favorites. She said it was embarrassing after seeing herself on screen. I'm always amazed at how many people call me when I'm on the air. Well, Lana worked hard on her career after she became the sweater girl and gained a lot of parts. Moved to MGM and signed her first contract months after her movie debut. But her popularity reached new levels during World War II when she starred in such films as Ziegfeld Girl in 1941 and Slightly Dangerous in 1943. Well, she worked with Clark Gable on several occasions, and her chemistry was such that Carol Lombard, who was Ms. Gable at the time, didn't particularly like the pair and would often visit the set just to keep an eye on both Lana and her husband. In fact, as documented, it was while rushing home from a Bond rally in order to reunite with Gable, who was filming with Turner, that Lombard died in a plane crash. That has never been suitably explained. Her death encouraged Gable to put his movie career on hold when he went into the military. Of course, he was never allowed to fly combat missions because it was felt that his death would be a blow to morale with the country. Lana threw herself into selling bonds as well as visiting soldiers in order to raise her spirits. When the war ended, she went on to star in the 1946 film The Postman Always Rings Twice, which buoyed her confidence as she had fought for a dramatic role for some time, and it actually cemented her reputation as a Hollywood star. But away from the screen, it was always Turner's personal life that caused the most waves in the newspaper, and she was known from an early age as a rebellious party girl who loved nightclubs and dancing. So much so that she was often seen hanging around at the Macombo and Ciro's, staying up late to drink cocktails, dance the night away, and spend time with various men who frequented both establishments. It was always said that Lana was a huge fan of the opposite sex. By the time she died in 1995, she had been married a staggering 8 times to 7 different men. She later wrote she found men to be exciting and couldn't understand any woman who didn't think that way, describing them as ladies with no corpuscles or as statues. A true romantic at heart, she believed she'd one day get the classic Hollywood ending and live happily ever after. But unfortunately, none of her marriages were successful, and a few even turned abusive and violent. She later described her first husband, bandleader Artie Shaw, as the most egotistical man she'd ever met. Then she added she hated him. Things weren't much better and often worse with her future husbands, but out of all the men in her life, maybe the second husband, Stephen Crane, made the most impact. It was him with whom she had her daughter, Cheryl. Stephen and Lana actually married twice, the first in 1942, which was annulled after he admitted to the actress that divorce from his last wife wasn't yet final. Information didn't sit well with Lana, as you might guess, and she decided to call the whole thing off that caused shockwaves in the studio and the newspapers, especially when it was discovered that she is pregnant, but still determined to annul the marriage. 6 months later, the couple reunited, married for the sake of their baby daughter, though ultimately the partnership wasn't a happy one. Of particular concern were the arguments that they had about the health of their baby, who had been born with a hereditary condition called Rh incompatibility. Baby needed several blood transfusions and stayed in the hospital for 2 months while she was treated, during which time Stephen unfairly blamed his wife for giving the condition to the child. This proved to be a factor in the eventual breakup of their marriage just a year later. Well, Lana's career and failed love life rattled on, but by 1956, her acting roles had been lacking in a certain something for quite some time, and MGM decided to terminate her contract after they failed to see any more potential in their star. Now, of course, Turner was devastated, and things didn't get much better when she miscarried a child in a 7-month of pregnancy. Shortly after that, she discovered that her then-husband, Lex Barker, who was one of the actors that played Tarzan, was abusing her daughter, Cheryl, and that marriage, quite understandably, ended in divorce. This led to a rebellion by the teenage child, who saw the relationship between mother and daughter strained to the limits. In truth, the bond between the pair had always been something less than perfect. Lana often leaving for long periods of time for work and conducted frequent romances, and that led the child to wonder if her mother really loved her. And after the debacle of the Barker marriage, Cheryl found herself not only acting up in front of Turner, but also running away after her mother ordered her back to boarding school. Story goes, on her way to her Flint Ridge school, she jumped out of the taxi, bid a friend goodbye with the words, "I'm not going back to school," and headed off into the streets of L.A. Well, she was found by a man while wandering around Skid Row, apparently being followed by some undesirables, and taken to the local police station. Well, the situation was eventually resolved, and Cheryl returned to school, but not before the entire incident made headlines around the world.
Facing financial hardship with a career in freefall, Lana threw herself into the search for a great role, which she ultimately found in a tremendously successful Peyton Place, co-starring Lee Phillip and Lloyd Nolan. Now, this was a great moment for Turner, but while the film had ultimately won her an Academy Award nomination, it was once again her personal life that hit the headlines. This time in the most dramatic fashion she could ever have imagined. Johnny Stampinato was known as a hard man who'd worked as a bodyguard for Mafia boss Mickey Colon, but it was his good looks and reputation as a fine lover that first attracted Lana. Unfortunately, he was also extremely violent during the course of their affair, not only abused Turner on a number of occasions, but also found himself deported from the UK after beating his lover during the making of her movie Another Time, Another Place. So bad was the beating, in fact, that the set had to be closed till she could recover, leading the British government to intervene and throw Stampinato out of the country. Later, Lana told the coroner's court that on one particular night in London, Stampinato got a razor from the bathroom and threatened to cut her face, declaring that he had started with a small cut to give her a taste of what it was like before doing worse things later on. In the end, he didn't really slash his lover, but by this time, Lana Turner was ready to say goodbye, though several attempts were ultimately unsuccessful. As much as he seemed to dislike the actress, Stampinato was in no hurry to leave her, and after the fiasco in London, she met her lover in Amsterdam, and together they flew to Acapulco for 2 months, where they spent time arguing instead of relaxing. In fact, it would seem the actress had actually thought she'd be going to Acapulco on her own, as she had written to the hotel a few months before, reserving her regular bungalow and making no mention of Stampinato. By the time they arrived together, it was rumored that the two never shared a room, Lana preferring instead to have separate accommodations from her volatile lover. The manager of the hotel, Ted Stauffer, later told the LA Times Lana's lover had stuck like glue and nobody ever had a chance to speak more than a few words to the actress the entire time she was there. However, on one occasion when Stauffer was able to get her alone for a minute, Turner did apparently hint she's worried about the situation from Stampinato and was desperately trying to get rid of him. Manager later told the press Stampinato acted like he knew it. When the couple returned to the States, they were met at the airport by Turner's mother and daughter. Actress was in no hurry to declare any kind of love for Johnny, and in fact, during a short interview with the waiting press, made the momentous decision to state there was absolutely no romance between the couple at all. Now, what Stampinato may have thought about this declaration wasn't known, but given his reputation, it probably wasn't a positive response. On the evening of the Academy Awards, where Lana was nominated for Best Actress, she celebrated with her daughter Cheryl, who was home from boarding school. Evening had been fun, but darkness lay ahead when they got back to their Beverly Hills hotel, and a tremendous fight broke out between Turner and Stampinato. He was furious he hadn't been Lana's date for the evening. For Cheryl, this was her first taste of the abuse being suffered by her mother, and as Johnny was threatening and hitting her mother, she pulled the covers up over her head in an attempt to drown out the noise. She told KMIR 6 News many years later, "I'm not proud of that, but I did." Well, despite the violence, it seemed that Stampinato had set his goal on marrying Lana Turner. On at least one occasion, he apparently took Cheryl out for hamburgers in the effort to win her over. His intention was for her to persuade her mother to consent to a wedding, though given his treatment of the woman, along with her desire to get away, it would seem something of a pie-in-the-sky idea. Indeed, Lana was so terrified of Stampinato, she would shake terrifically every time a quarrel erupted between them. Now, with that in mind, it was clear that marriage was the very last thing she ever wanted with him. Well, several days after the Academy Awards on March 31st, 1958, violence again erupted when Lana and Cheryl were staying at the home of the actress's mother, Mildred, where they were getting themselves ready to move into their new home. Johnny was with Lana that day and started an argument over nothing in particular, only this time it was different, as Cheryl decided to confront her mother about it after he had left. You know, the actress admitted to her daughter Stampinato had hurt her in the past. When asked why she wouldn't leave the man, Lana replied it isn't that easy, and she went on to explain how possessive he was and that she didn't have a moment to herself without him wanting to know what she was doing and who she was with. Both Cheryl and Lana were beside themselves with worry, and it looked at that point as if the actress was never going to get away from Johnny Stampinato. Well, on April 4th, 1958, which also happened to be Good Friday, Lana was planning on spending Easter quietly with her daughter at their new home at 730 North Bedford Drive, where they'd moved just 3 days before. Unfortunately, the arrival of Stompanato changed that. It was anything but a good Friday for everybody involved. Lana had long since known the rumors of her boyfriend's mafia connections, but recently she had become aware not only was he working for mafia boss Mickey Colon, but for some reason, he was also lying to her about his age, saying he was 41 when he was only 31. She decided to address the issues that evening, told her daughter she was going to end the relationship once and for all. She told Cheryl not to believe anything Johnny said and to pay no attention to him, which the child had no intention doing anyway, since she had by now decided that he was not the sort of person with whom she wanted to spend time. Of course, while Lana was insisting that the relationship would end, Stompanato would prove time and again he wasn't the type to go quietly. Wasn't long, therefore, before things got ugly and a violent argument broke out between the pair in Lana's bedroom. Cheryl was doing homework in her own room at the time and heard the man shouting. But it was when she heard him threaten to destroy not only her mother's looks, but her family, including the child herself, that Lana's daughter decided something had to be done. So Cheryl went to see if her mother was okay, but fearing for her safety, Lana told her daughter to go back to her room. Instead, in a sudden burst of daring protectiveness for Lana, 14-year-old Cheryl ran to the kitchen, got a knife from the counter, turned, dashed back upstairs, and listened outside Lana's bedroom. It was at that point that the door flew open, and according to Cheryl, Stompanato walked out of the room just as she was going in and ran straight into the path of her knife. He looked her in the eyes, asked what on earth she had done, and fell on the ground, lying on his back and making terrible gasping sounds as he died. Well, seeing the severity of what she had done, a shocked Cheryl ran back to her bedroom while Lana Turner rushed over to see what was wrong with her lover. Now, she hadn't seen the knife, she said, and it wasn't until after she lifted his cardigan that she realized there was a wound. She ran to the bathroom to get a towel in order to try to stop the bleeding. She couldn't believe it. She had wished her lover to leave, wondering if she'd ever escape his outburst, but she didn't want him dead, and yet there he was in the middle of the bedroom in her new home, looking like something out of a horror movie. Well, Lana's first reaction was to call the doctor, but not being able to call his name, she took the decision to phone her mother, who then turned to telephone the doctor herself. Cheryl then came back to the bedroom where she was trying to help staunch the bleeding, this time with her mother's washcloths that were found in the bathroom. Told her mother she didn't mean to do it, to which Lana told her not to worry. Her grandmother was calling the doctor. Everything would be okay. Well, running once again from the bedroom, Cheryl called her father, Stephen Crane, who soon arrived at the house to be greeted by his daughter, running down the path to meet him. She took him inside, and he ran up the stairs to Lana's bedroom where the actress was still with her lover. He took one look at the dying man and asked what happened. Cheryl said, "I did it, Daddy," and assured him she didn't mean to. The man had been going to hurt her mother before she'd come into the room. Well, the Crane took his daughter back to her bedroom, trying to calm her down, assure everything would be okay. Shortly after that, Lana's mother, Mildred, showed up and, first of all, calmed down her granddaughter before taking matters into her own hands as she tried frantically to rouse the wounded man. Well, by this point, it was no point in trying to rouse him when she returned to Cheryl's bedroom where she and Stephen were sitting. Stephen took one look at her face and knew that hope for Stompanato was a thing of the past. By the time the doctor arrived, things were looking worse than ever. He demanded the actress call an ambulance and gave Stompanato an injection of adrenaline. Well, while waiting for the ambulance, Stompanato's heart finally stopped beating. The doctor continued to work on it, but he knew it was too late. By this time, the house began to fill with people, including Lana's lawyer, Jerry Geisler, several other doctors, and the police and the ambulance crew. Everybody played a part in trying to save the man and then trying to figure out exactly what had happened. What an easy task, as by this time, Lana's mind was a blur, but eventually a statement was taken and the body of Stompanato was taken away for autopsy. Well, the decision not to immediately call the police upset Stompanato's family. They later complained to the newspapers that if they'd called the police and an ambulance as soon as it happened, the man could still be alive. Well, the autopsy showed that wasn't the case, and the knife had pierced the abdominal wall, the liver, and the aorta, meaning Stompanato would have been dead within a very short time after the stabbing. Cheryl Crane was sent to juvenile hall for questioning where police did everything about the book. They were determined not to be told they were letting the daughter of Lana Turner get away with murder. Well, On that note, we've run out of time. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll have more stories about the great, the near great, and the famous and the infamous. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.